If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Tommy, this has got to be the most expensive Forerunner I've ever been in because, of course, this is a TRD Pro. It's a 2026. And it's in this crazy wave maker turquoise.
Turquoise is the color, that's right. So this is the new specialty TRD Pro color for 2026. Definitely one of the boldest I've ever seen.
Yeah, and the question that we're gonna try to answer in this video is, at $74,000, would you get this over a Wrangler or a Bronco? Dare I say, Tommy, a Bronco Raptor.
Well,
you're 5K away from that.
Yeah, we're not quite there, but we're definitely knocking on the door, and certainly you could get a very nice Wrangler Rubicon for $74,000. But what I want to do in today's off-road podcast number 3,
yep,
if I remember correctly, is we're going to do a walk around of this thing. We're going to get it out off-road, and then later in the video, Case and I are going to go back into the studio, talk about the news of the week and everything you need to know about the off-road world. But Dad, let's do a quick walk around this wave maker.
Yeah, let's. I mean, we kind of hinted at the fact that this is a very expensive car, and I don't know what happened to the Monroney.
It's in the center console there.
Oh, thank you. That's good to know. All right, so I've got the Monroney right here, Tommy, and this starts out at $67,900,
yep,
but as tested, we're at $74,263. Then that's because it's got, gosh, $7,000 worth of options. And the Wavemaker color, guess how much?
$695.
Yeah, you saw this already. But the most expensive option on here is the ARB roof rack, $1,710.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's pretty cool. So it's like a 3/4 length platform. So if you wanted to put a tent or all sorts of accessories up there, that certainly is a good option. This one also has the frame mounted rock rails. What do those cost?
Those are $990, Tommy.
And it even has little things like this one's got the Wavemaker overlay there in the grill with the Toyota emblem. What's that run you?
$189. It also has the dash cam front integrated. That's $500. We'll show you that once we go inside. But when you add all this stuff up, also it has a $425 rear skid plate covering the rear diff. So that is an addition to what normally you get on this vehicle. So you're at $74,000, but you get a lot of goodies for that. Let's start with the shocks.
Yeah, so this is of course a TRD Pro version of the Forerunner. So we get the Fox QS3 2.5-inch diameter aluminum shock absorbers with the remote resis in the back. You know, an expensive shock setup, internal bypass, of course. And this is kind of the ultimate off-road Forerunner. So this and the Trail Hunter are kind of battling it out at the top for the most capability you can get.
Now, if you guys remember, we bought last year, actually, about this time when the Forerunner came out, the TRD Off-Road. And I have to say, I got a little bit of jealousy when it comes to this one, because this one is so much nicer. Not only do you have the tow package, but you also have all kinds of goodies on the inside, which we'll go through. But I do really think that if you're going to go 4Runner, and if you've got the money, go for this one in Wavebreaker turquoise, because it's got a lot of cool stuff.
I don't think it's Wavebreaker.
Wavemaker.
Wavemaker.
Did I say breaker?
Yeah, there you go.
Sorry, Wavemaker.
Now, so look, Toyota has a long history of these one-off colors for model years. So like Voodoo Blue, they had the green. I think there was an orange one. But Wavemaker is certainly kind of my favorite. I really like it a lot.
Hey, I kind of like Wavebreaker better. I just feels a little bit more like, you know, manly. I break waves instead of I make waves.
So some other things we need to talk about. We do, of course, have the upgraded suspension. We also have those beautiful red upper control arms, which is cool. 18-inch wheels, 3-peak snow rated, by the way. These are the Toyo Open Country AT3s. It's about a 33-inch tall tire.
Yeah, let me open up the hood to start there, because you can get your 4Runner in two flavors, same engine but two flavors. There is a non-hybrid, which we had, and then there is this hybrid. I think all TRD Pros are hybrid.
Yep, that's right. So 326 horsepower, 465 pound-feet of torque. But the best part,
I got it, Tommy. You got engine, the camera.
I got you.
There you go.
Oh, they don't give you struts.
No, I'll hold it up for you.
Is the cold air intake. Look at this. This is, well, medium cold air intake, I should say. What's cool about it, TRD got these red intake pipes, even has the red intake horn down there. Now, I was reading that this is a change for 26 model year.
Uh-huh.
4Runner has more sound deadening material throughout.
Yeah, but isn't there supposed to be like an air intake right here that then is fed through by this hood scoop?
Yeah, not very functional there.
Because we know that the air comes in over here.
Yeah, exactly.
Where's the hood scoop? It should be over here.
I know. Yeah. Now, in the front of this, you do have the rigid industry lights here, the Toyota LED light there.
And show my favorite part. Yeah, right there, that's a good plate. That's this TRD Pro on it. That's badass.
That's pretty cool. No, I mean, I think it's a good-looking, attractive vehicle. Of course, based on the TNGAF architecture, along with, I think, every now Toyota and Lexus body-on-frame vehicle is TNGAF, just some variation of that. Now, compared to Wrangler and Bronco, you can get a Wrangler on 35s. You can get a Bronco on 35s or 37s. So a Toyota is definitely a little bit small on tire size.
Well, you know, Toyota's always been more concerned with fuel economy. You know, that's why we have almost every Toyota comes in a hybrid model. And you start putting 35s and 37s on, and it's gonna freak the Toyota engineers out, Tommy, because fuel economy will go out the window. By the way, this one is 23 combined.
And people are already doing that, so they may be freaked out, but they're doing it one way or another.
You wanna show them the inside?
Yeah.
Because it's really nice on the inside.
Now, I think that this is certainly an area that Toyota does shine, especially over the Bronco, interior quality, fit and finish. The Pro gets a lot of red accents, so here across the dash, red contrast stitching, these unique seats that have these kind of camo finish in them, although, if I pop open the back here, it doesn't have the shock absorbers like you'd find in the Tacoma TRD Pro.
Yeah, and forgive us for having all of our stuff. I do think it's fair to mention that Toyota flew us out here to California. We're at an off-road park called Dove something. I think it's in the Mojave Desert, and we're on our way to Mammoth because Toyota lent us this to go ski and surf, Tommy. So we're first going to go take this to ski, and then we're going to go back to LA and go surf. How crazy is that?
Yeah, pretty cool.
All right, you want to show them the other kind of fun goodies on the driver's side? Because there are some goodies. There's some hidden Easter eggs.
Yeah, so this one's got some accessories on it. Like, it's got the little camping lantern. So if I twist here in the dash, pull out, it has a little hook on it. This is actually an integrated lantern. That's kind of fun. And then it also has the JBL speaker in the dash. So this is, they're going after the camping crowd with this. Pop that out, you know, listen to your tunes. And then up here is where you're gonna find your built-in dash cam, which keeps going off every time we hit a little bump off-road, kind of funny. So there's your button for your LED light bar, 4 auxiliary switches, your four-wheel drive selector down here, two-wheel drive, four-wheel drive high and low, rear locker, stabilizer bar disconnect, tow mode, and this does have, quite handily, an integrated brake controller.
But it is missing a front locker if you're...
It is.
If you're comparing it to a Bronco or a Wrangler, and that's kind of a head-scratcher. At 74,000, look, you can get the LX with... That's triple locked, right? The Lexus.
Mm-hmm.
The Toyota Land Cruiser isn't triple locked, but the one that we have at the office right now is actually 70,000. And it does have, unlike this one, a heads-up display and a cool box, Tommy.
Well, let's do this then. I'm going to grab our In-N-Out cups,
Well, you forgot to show them the coolest part.
What's the coolest part?
Well, come on back here.
What you got there?
Oh, I gotta show you this. All the foreigner fans are freaking out because you didn't show them the thing that they all love.
Well, I think by 1984 to today, most people would probably know this by now. Yep, window still goes down. It's 42 years old, Dad.
I know, but this is I like it. So you don't have to actually open up this rear. I'll just do it this way. You don't have to open up this rear if you don't want. I also like that we've got a tow package and a brake controller. Now there is a little bit less room back here because this is where the battery lives. And there's a little cubby compartment over here that you can pull out, but because I got my skis in here and all of our bags, it's hard to put back. And you can't get the rear seat on this TRD Pro, can you?
No, no third row option. Well, let's do this, Dad. Close it up.
Yeah.
And we got to go take him for a little spin.
Okay, you want me to drive or you want to drive?
No, you drive.
Okay, here, you take the key then. Why are you giving me your empty cup?
Because I only have two hands.
Give me my full cup.
It's right here. I just need a little bit of help, please.
You know, it's funny, we still come and get In-N-Out when we come to California, even though In-N-Out is now in Colorado.
Nah, it just feels right, though, when you're in the sun. So, let's talk about this tech here. 14-inch display. Pretty big old screen. You even have the digital rearview mirror
there.
Which
you hate, and I like.
Yeah, it always gives me headaches, those digital rearview mirrors.
Dual temperature zones, cooled and heated seats.
Nice.
Heated steering wheel.
Nice.
All kinds of Toyota safety sense, whatever .0 we're at now.
I think it's 3.
So you do have like lane keep and lane centering, which is, we just used the driving up here. It's okay. It's still, you know, prehistoric compared to like the Tesla FSB supervised, full self-driving supervised that we have where it'll actually drive you.
So go through the gates there.
Okay.
And we'll do the little hill climb we did earlier.
Okay.
I'll hop on out. Because we're not at our usual off-road test course in Colorado. We got to improvise a little. But I do want to show the fine folks how this thing does.
I'm going to open up the windows because it's so nice.
Yeah, it's really nice. So yeah. We've got this thing in 4-low. We've got multi-terrain select and crawl control. So it is dialed for, you know, your off-road adventures. I mean, it doesn't have a front locker, but multi-terrain select and crawl control get you most places you need to go.
So a good thing and bad thing. Come on, we're off-road. It's going to be a little.
Well, I'm a baby.
So a good thing and a bad thing. I'll start with the good thing. We've been doing kind of off-roading out here, just trying it out, and what we have found is that these diffs go from 2 high to 4 high to 4 low very easily.
Yeah, the transfer case.
The transfer case, sorry. In the past, it's always been a little like you had to drive it a little bit. It was always kind of hit and miss. Now it seems to be working much better. The miss is if you leave your door cracked open and you try to move the car, like to park it, the parking brake stays on and the car doesn't go anywhere. It's really annoying in some ways.
All right, I'm going to hop out here.
All right, I'm going to go up this hill. Is that what you want
me to do? We got to give it some kind of dramatic name. It's YouTube.
Oh, this hill, yeah?
We're going to call it the Sandy Knoll of Death.
I was going to call it the Wave Breaker.
Yeah, that's actually a good name.
See, thank you.
All right, do you want to talk or should I talk?
You can talk.
All right, I'll show you.
Hey, what I'll do, Tommy, is just so you know, I'll go up this and then I'll go over that crack and you can actually see the articulation.
Sure.
All right.
So here in the Sandy Knoll of Death.
Wave Breaker.
We've got this kind of crack here in the earth, which splits apart here, and then it grows to this gully here that my dad's going to try to traverse. And if our tire's not big enough, we're going to dig that front skid plate into the earth. Oh, it looks totally flat on camera, but it's pretty steep in person. All right, here comes that blue runner. Oh, it does look cool out on the trail. I really like that color a lot. It's just nice having actual colors in 2026. All right, Dad, that looks really good. So that right front's gonna dip down into this gully. Nice and slow, a little bit driver. Nice. Let me get a quick look at that ground clearance. It's quite a, kind of a lot. Oh, harder driver. Oh, okay, stop.
I'm falling into the hole, ain't I?
Yeah, I gotta go more.
Oh.
More driver.
There you go. I've been off-road a few times.
Nice. So even fully aired up, because here in California we don't have any of our air-down gear, it still holds up pretty well and gets to where you need to go.
You know, it's going to get really tight over there. I think I'm going to have to take this other path.
Sure.
So I might have to go. I don't want to fall in the sandy hole of death or whatever you called it.
Sandy Knoll.
Sandy Knoll of Death, sorry. I'll just go this way.
There you go.
And we'll go around here so we don't scratch up Toyota's brand new This is brand new. We got 156 miles on it so far. Yeah.
Yeah, we picked it up at 21 miles.
Yeah, I know.
So, I know I'm being a bit dramatic about this ride quality, but it is very firm.
Yeah, that's always been the thing about the 4Runner, right? It's always been a little choppy.
A little choppy.
Yeah, a little choppy.
Yeah, for sure. You want to go through that? That's our little gate there, and that'll take us back down to the main road here.
Yeah.
So this is an interesting little open area that is available here in California to road users. So if you're out here and you want to have some fun exploring, you can do that. It's beautiful scenery. Look at that.
I wonder if you can turn off these...
parking sensors, you can.
Yeah, because I'm sure it's somewhere in there.
I think it's
there.
In the center screen.
Yeah, I know. But it's always a...
Pretty sure. I wish they just had an off button.
It's always an adventure to get to, isn't it?
A hammer.
Yeah.
This is off.
Yeah, just off. Yeah.
Oh, boy. So this is the problem
with
the hood.
This is the problem. You can't see over the hood, so you have to use the camera. But the problem with the camera is it doesn't show you any depth.
I think we can also just make the front bigger. There we go.
Doesn't help.
Oh, that kind of helps a little. I mean, that your fake hood scoop there is so big, it just eats away at the forward visibility.
It certainly does. But yeah, you're right. This ride's a little, and I think we've got our sway bar disconnected, actually.
Do we?
I think
it reconnected.
You think it reconnected?
Yeah, there you go.
All right, now which way?
That would have been good through our sandy knoll of death. That would have helped us out. back to the road, and then we're going to go left.
Okay.
Yeah, and we'll finish it up in the trailhead down the street. So I think that they've done a lot right with this car. I mean, it's the right size, it's got the right clearances, and it's got the right tires, and that'll get you most of the way where you need to go. I think that the back seat's a little bit compromised for carrying passengers anything bigger than little kids, and I think that the price is kind of outrageous.
Yeah, but everything's outrageous these days, Tommy. So they just dropped the price on the Bronco Raptor. So it was 90, it's now down to 80.
Uh-huh.
And you do get a six-cylinder there, and you do get a twin turbo, and you do get, obviously, a convertible.
Well, 37s.
And you get 37s with front lockers. So for $5,000 more.
Is that really only 80?
Yeah, I think they went from 90. They dropped to $10,000.
Oh.
Yeah, and then, of course, the Jeep 392 is coming out, the Willys, and that's going to start at
70.
So you're at 70, so you could get yourself... A Willys, it won't have a hard top, it'll just have a soft top. Let me put this in 4 high.
Let's see if your test is right about how easy it is to switch.
Okay, there's 4 high, and click, and there we are.
Nice.
Look at that. Yeah.
You know,
good job, Toyota.
It's usually the locker that's the problem, though.
Yeah. This has also been an issue. I remember when Andre and I first drove the new Tundra, we had a hell of a time getting it from 4 low to 4 high. So literally. We had to drive like a quarter mile.
That little beep is the dash cam thinking you got into a minor accident.
Yeah. But does it record automatically?
I think it does, yeah. So Toyota's going to have a lot of really boring clips of off-roading by the time we're back with this. But no, I mean, I think that the certainly the design is here. It's a very cool-looking vehicle. The capability is definitely there. You know, when we get this back to Colorado, we'll really put it through the test. But we've driven 4Runners off-road. We've taken them to some pretty extreme places, and they do continue to just come back for more.
Look, the bottom line, now we asked this question, would you get a Bronco or a Wrangler? And the answer is pretty straightforward. It depends. Do you want to get a vehicle for how you use it most of the time or how you use it some of the time? Because the issue with both the Wrangler and the Bronco is that they're very compromised, especially the Wrangler when it comes to on-street performance.
Mm.
Whereas this is very comfortable-ish on-street. So, you know, this doesn't make that many compromises
For off-roading,
because you have this hard top, right, that doesn't whistle, squeal, or do any strangeness. You have a relatively comfortable seating position, unlike the Wrangler, where, you know, your face is up against the glass. You have, real lumbar support. And the Bronco kind of cuts the difference between the two of them. If this is the most on-road worthy, with a lot of off-road capability, and the Wrangler is incredibly off-road worthy with kind of iffy on-road capability, the Broncos kind of splits the difference. It's kind of in between there. So it's livable on-road, and it's very good off-road. So it really depends on, you know, do you buy a vehicle for what you are going to use it for or what you think you're going to use it for, or do you know exactly what you're going to use it for?
Yeah, I think that's a good analysis. But look, I think that I really hope they bring this color into the normal 4Runner lineup because it is so cool. That's really the big change for 26. Although I was reading they did add, we can just park it here, Dad.
Yeah.
Yeah, we don't want to go down these little things.
Yeah, you might get some
pinstriping.
Yeah.
I was reading they did add the availability of the stability bar disconnect to more vehicles for 26, which is cool. So, you know, they've done some nice improvements there.
Yeah, the other thing I don't love is the engine note.
No, it sounds like rocks in a blender.
Yeah, it's not great, but there's tons of torque and there's, you know, great power. So even though it doesn't sound great, you never feel like you're lacking any.
But on the plus side of it being a hybrid, you do get 2,400 watts of power for when you're camping, and that's huge.
And I think, Tommy, this is, of course, the most expensive version of the Pro you can get, especially with this paint job. And there will be people who will be clamoring to get one of these Wave Maker Forerunner TRD Pro off-roads, right?
Just TRD Pros.
I know.
Cool. All right, that's all we got to say about that one.
Oh, there's a lot of electricity here. I can hear it.
Yeah, that is.
That's why I got stuck talking, because all of a sudden I heard this, like, the crinkle of the, of the power going through the power lines, and I was like, where the hell did I stop?
Yeah. So, guys, let us know what you think. Is this a better option than the Ford or the Jeep? And now we're going to cut to the studio, and we're going to bring you some news.
All right, we're back in the studio after talking about some Toyotas, and now we're going to definitely not talk about Toyotas because our first segment is news of the week. Now, this came out a little while ago, but I think it's very important we talk about. Apparently, Lincoln is working on a body-on-frame SUV to compete with the G-Class, which is crazy. So what do you think of that, Case?
It would be interesting to see what they do if they base it off of the Bronco, which would kind of make sense because that's obviously a very capable platform. But the Bronco doesn't really lend itself very well to being refined, and Lincoln has to be refined. So I'd be surprised if they do an entire bespoke platform for that vehicle. But if not the Bronco, then what do you base it on?
Yeah, I know. It's interesting. So this is according to Auto Week. Apparently, it's supposed to launch in 2029 or 2030. But this is a really interesting topic because I remember reading something a while back that it was reported Audi may be working on a G-Wagon competitor based on the Scout platform. So I think that Mercedes has had that segment of kind of the ultra luxury, but also very capable four-wheel drive to itself for a long time.
Yeah, it seems like everyone's trying to compete with the G-Wagon now, and even Mercedes themselves, they're bringing out a what's being referred to as a baby G-Wagon. So there's been camouflage prototypes of the smaller, very boxy, rugged Mercedes SUV that already Land Rover has a prototype they've been testing that seems to be targeting the yet-to-be-released baby G-Wagon that a lot of people are thinking is going to be under the Defender brand and might be called the Defender Sport.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's an interesting topic, but I think what's key about this and what Lincoln has to get right, same thing with Audi, is if they actually want to compete with the G, they have to make it a genuine four-wheel drive, right?
For sure.
It can't just be another Navigator. It's got to be something. It can't even be a Navigator Tremor. It's got to be something, I think, that's got not only the look, but the potential to be awesome out in the dirt. Because that's the appeal of the G-Wagon. Yeah, technically no one will ever see the dirt in it, but it's knowledge that, like, it's got all of the things you need. So when the apocalypse comes, you can look cool wearing your red bottomed heels. You know what I'm saying?
Sort of. Yeah, I agree that I think it's a key part of the G-Wagon that it has those three buttons in the center of the dash. The center locker, the front locker, and the rear locker are all an important part of the DNA of that vehicle, even if they put it on what look like autocross tires. Funny enough, even the G580 with EQ technology, in other words, the electric G-Wagon that Tommy and I tested, we did a slip test on that, took it through our trenches. And that was our joke, is that the tires that G-Wagon came on from the factory looked like autocross tires. They looked like performance summer tires, which doesn't necessarily not make any sense because it does have a lot of power. But when we tested it on the slip test, even the electric G-Wagon with its mechanical low range for each of the four electric motors did shockingly well. It doesn't have a lot of clearance. It doesn't have the right tires. Doesn't have the most amount of articulation, but it has a pretty fantastic four-wheel drive system. Maybe the best four-wheel drive system we've tested in any EV, just not paired up to tires and ground clearance that let you do anything with it. So it is a fundamental part of the G-Wagon to have that DNA. So I agree. If Lincoln's actually going to successfully target the G-Wagon, it has to be capable in some sense.
What do you think? Bronco with some leather on the dash, would that work?
Maybe in the late 90s, but not today. I just don't know how you're going to adapt the Bronco platform into a luxury vehicle.
Well, it would be tough because fundamentally when the top comes off, it does create a compromised experience, right? Because you end up with a lot of removable panels that are hard to weather seal and hard to noise proof, and it is a challenge.
And if you make a hard top only Lincoln version of the Bronco, then it might be hard to justify why spend more money on that when it has one less feature that I think brings a lot of people into the Bronco, the removable top. I think that's an important feature.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is potential in that Bronco platform that is undiscovered. I just think that it's going to take a substantial amount of re-engineering. I think that, you know, that basic ladder frame with the front and rear lockers and even the powertrains, I think, you know, if they launched that thing with a 3-liter twin turbo, you know, as standard, if you're going to compete on that level, it's got to be a very powerful unit. And then I think if they do make it a hardtop and they make it look substantially different and they make it actually nice inside, there is a potential there.
How about this?
What's your thinking?
If they want to sell a lot of them, even though the power figures might not be the headline, if they put the Coyote V8, which they won't do, but if they put the Coyote V8 into a Lincoln version of a Bronco, that would make people buy it.
That'd be cool.
And you could make the interior nicer. You could try and make the sound deadening better. Maybe soften up the suspension a little bit. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, not such a cabbage cart.
What would you call it? What's like a fancy horse?
Oh, I should know this.
Doesn't your mom do horse stuff?
Yeah, she does do horse stuff.
Cole, what's the name of a fancy horse?
Cole doesn't know.
No, just a fancy horse.
Any
thing.
Brand, make, model of horse.
Clydesdale? Ooh, I like that. Good. That's good.
I think that's what the Budweiser horses are.
The Lincoln Clydesdale. It's got a ring to it.
Cole knows stuff.
Cole does know stuff. That's very cool. All right, next piece of news I want to talk about has to do with the Super Duty lineup. Mm-hmm. They're expanding the Tremor name, which is kind of their off-road spec of Super Duty, to other products within the Super Duty lineup. Do you want to explain that?
Yeah, so as with any truck configurator and all of the possibilities, it is somewhat complicated, but in its simplest form, what Ford is doing is they're going to make it so that you could get the Tremor package on basically any trim of Super Duty truck, from XL all the way up to Platinum. So you can get a more basic Tremor. You can also get a long bed Tremor truck, which you couldn't do in the past. So, you know, earlier Andre and I were talking about this. He brought up a good point. Maybe if you have a sizable camper, but you still want to be able to navigate some rough roads, and a long bed Tremor might make sense. Tremor package, for most people, they are probably familiar, but it gives you 35s, slightly taller suspension, rear locker, limited slip diff in the front, some underbody protection, and slightly better shocks. And the other update that they're doing, so for a long time they've had the XL Off-Road, which is a very basic truck that gives you 33s and a rear locker, and you can option it with a winch and everything from the factory. So the XL Off-Road is pretty simple, pretty basic. But now they're also offering on the XL trim an XL Off-Road 35s. So it's basically an unbranded Tremor package. Because one of the caveats with the Tremor package, it is. One of the caveats with the Tremor package is that you can only get it on crew cabs. So if you want a more capable single cab truck, something super basic, and you would get XL Off-Road with 35s, which is basically a Tremor package.
Is that that?
Yeah, so that's an XL Off-Road with 35s. So that's got the 35s, front lock or rear locker, front limited slip. Does it make sense?
Nothing rolls off the tongue like Ford F-250 XL Off-Road 35s.
Yeah.
No, so. I mean, my only issue with this, I think it's great that they're expanding that capability across the lineup. And to your point, like, it looks like anything from XL through, like, could you get a King Ranch trimmer?
I mean, to my knowledge, so the configurator hasn't gone live yet, so we haven't actually had the chance. I think by the time this podcast goes live, the configurator will be live. But my understanding, you can get an XL upward with a Tremor package from this point on. It has to be crew cab, though.
So the only issue I have with that, Cole, if you could go back to that previous picture, we had an STX Tremor, which is kind of like a more entry-level truck-ish. It's nicer than the Off-Road. There it is. So that one is then a Tremor,
yes.
I think, right? You can see it on the back.
Yep.
But they are diluting the brand a little bit, because one of the things that made the Tremor cool is it was very distinguishable as a Tremor. Like when it launched in the F-150, you remember, and I think maybe even 250, it had the orange tow hooks, had these very special graphics. This STX just looks like any other STX with a little Tremor thing on the rear quarter. So it kind of feels like they're making the Tremor the new FX4 in some ways. You know, is that fair to say?
It could be, but it comes with a lot more content because you do get that limited slip diff in the front, 35-inch tires, rear locker, which that alone makes it genuinely pretty capable. So the capability is still there.
And you can get it, like, it sounds like diesel and gassers, potentially.
Yeah, for sure. That's cool. The only way you can get an XL with a Tremor is if you get the STX package. That makes it a little nicer.
It's so confusing.
So the Tremor trucks are always going to be a little bit nicer. They now have a more entry-level Tremor, but if you want a really basic truck with off-road features, you do one of the XL off-road packages.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting discussion. I mean, I think that we're seeing across all of the sizes of trucks, people want to be able to buy a more capable machine.
Yeah.
The Ford still doesn't have quite the same level of capability that Ram is though offering in the Power Wagon.
Yeah, right? The new diesel Power Wagon, which is exciting, you can spec with a front locker. The diesel Power Wagon cannot be spec'd with a factory winch, which is a little bit of a difference. So on the Ford trucks, you can spec a winch. We even had... I think we had at one point, you remember that red Platinum Plus that we towed the Model T out to Moab with?
Yes.
I think that had a winch.
Yeah, that was cool.
That was a high output diesel and everything. Yeah. So pretty impressive packaging that they were able to do all that.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Okay, so that's kind of the only news, I think, of the week this week. Not a really big week. There is one other news story. I guess Jeep fixed the Wrangler so it would stop rolling over when the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety would crash them.
Small overlap?
Yeah, is that what it was?
I think that was the test where they were rolling over. And granted, that is one of, if not the hardest
tests to
pass.
You said they modified the frame a little bit?
Yeah, they made some updates to frame rails, and I guess it doesn't flip over anymore. So that's a good thing.
Good news.
Yeah.
That's always good news.
It used to be back in the day that if you even used the brakes on a 4x4, they would flip over.
So that's a great segment to our latest purchase. It's actually not a purchase.
A gift.
Here's a story. We've been renting a storage unit from Andre's uncle for the last few years now, actually a bunch of years. And there was a bit of a situation, and Andre's uncle has to stay where he's at right now. So he has no use for this 1995 Isuzu Rodeo anymore. But we prepaid a bunch of rent, so he's trying to sell his place. So in exchange for the rent, he's giving us this 1995 Isuzu Rodeo. Now, this is a first-generation rodeo.
It is, yeah. And admittedly, it's not in the greatest condition. It leaks a lot, makes a lot of noises, especially the top end of its V6 makes a lot of noises. But it's a 5-speed manual, 4-wheel drive with a low range. So it's a pretty neat vehicle. The funny thing about these is that apparently back in the day, if you slammed on the brakes in the rain, supposedly, they would pretty much immediately go sideways and flip over.
So I'm going to airdrop you a picture, Cole. Now, what I love about this machine is this is the video is pretty popular. I think it's because that this is kind of in that space now where they were really, 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 really popular back in the day. Mm-hmm. And then people have just forgotten they've existed, right? So this is, I think the series that we're working on is a little bit nostalgic for a lot of people, because a lot of people had these rodeos. They were very, very popular. And then be it just age or rust or mechanical issues, they've all kind of just disappeared off the road. I can't remember the last time I've seen one, especially a first generation rodeo. So when we put out the video, there's a bunch of people that had stories to tell us who sent us emails about rodeos.
Yeah.
Now, our first email is from our friend Sam. Sam is actually an engineer. He's also in the industry. If you listen to last week's car podcast, Sam talked about his experience. I'm sorry, Cole. My airdrop is saying it. Here we go. It's coming to you. So Sam, back in the day, was an engineer with General Motors, and he actually was one of the folks that developed the ABS systems for the first generation Isuzu Rodeo. Here's an image of him developing the ABS system. It's not going super well.
Yeah.
Because the car is on its side. So here's what Sam said. You bought a rodeo. Please be careful with that thing because it will roll over if you look at it funny. Back in the 90s, these things were sold in multiple badges, including Rodeo Amigo, which was a two-door rodeo, mm-hmm. Honda Passport, and the Vauxhall and Opel Frontera.
Yeah, so that's what we have a picture of right there.
He said, I sadly got to spend way too much time with these things as an engineer because we had a contract to put together the Kelsey Hayes ABS system. I was working on the Opel Vauxhall variant. Others used a Denso ABS. In the span of 2 years, we had more rollovers with these things than anything else we ever worked on, including one that nearly killed a coworker while testing in Japan. It was the closest I ever came to a rollover while testing at the Chelsea Proving Grounds. I've got multiple photos from an incident in northern Sweden in January of 93. He said, simply lifting out the accelerator without ever touching the brakes on a slippery surface would send these things into a spin. They are among the worst vehicles I've ever driven.
So,
not a glowing review.
In a way, Andre's uncle did us a favor, and in a way, we may have done him a favor. I don't know which it is.
But what do you think about this thing? You've driven it a little bit.
I have. It's neat, especially for the price, which is essentially nil. And I think that we should, Tommy likes this idea too, I think we should try to drive it on two wheels.
Did you not just read the email we got about them rolling over really easily?
Well, yeah, clearly they tip very easily, which means it wouldn't be difficult to get it on two wheels.
All right. But I do have to say, regardless of the rollover thing, which granted might be a big problem, I do love the rodeo because this whole era of 90s Japanese four-wheel drives, this was such a good era of vehicle. They were really well made. They are very simple to drive and operate. They feel like they'll last forever, and they're shockingly capable just because they're so much smaller than the modern stuff.
Exactly. That's the key thing, is they're compact and they're light. And this class of vehicle in this day and age doesn't really exist anymore because there are a lot of rugged, if you want to call it that, crossovers, but none of them have low ranges. Almost none of them have low ranges. And most of them are all-wheel drive instead of a traditional four-wheel drive system. So they don't really have the same underpinnings. So if you want a more traditional 4x4 with that kind of hardware, you got to step into something like a full-size Bronco or a Wrangler,
yeah,
which is essentially a bigger, more expensive vehicle.
So we got another email I want to read from a gentleman named Dan, and he starts off by saying, 1,000 years ago, I started my career as an Isuzu tech at a dealer. The first-gen rodeo was designed and built when GM owned a large percentage of Isuzu, but very few parts were sourced from GM. Isuzu tried really hard, but just didn't have the R&D budget to develop two new V6 engines. So he goes on to talk about our 3.2 liter, which has a pretty nasty tick in it.
It does. It is very loud and not in the right way.
So Dan goes on to say the single cam 3.2 liter V6 was really close to being as good as something like the 3.4 Toyota V6. And people who did frequent synthetic oil changes had almost no problems with them. Then he goes on to say there were a couple different major issues with them, specifically related to ticks. First was the timing belt tensioner, and the second was the ticking noise from the valve train. The design of the valve train and cylinder head would be awesome if they were reliable. They copied some things Honda were doing, but it also worked like the inside of a piano. There are two hollow steel shafts bolted to the cylinder head. The one closest to the single camshaft has 6 rocker arms for the intake, but also 6 finger followers, which kind of, you know, essentially transmit the motions. He goes on to say, those are the big problem. They're very small and have tiny check balls that stop working, letting oil bleed out. And he kind of explains that they tend to sludge up and then they wear and then they're very expensive and challenging to fix. So essentially the engine is bulletproof except for the valve train, which is fundamentally kind of flawed in its design. Also the lug nuts.
Yeah, so apparently, well, we realized pretty quickly that ours is missing a few of its lug nuts. Apparently that's not altogether uncommon on these.
Yeah, he says the design of the lug nuts is terrible. The steel wheels pinch the soft steel of the lug nuts, then they destroy the studs and get stuck. Best to ditch the 3-piece lug nuts and center caps and use the regular acorn lug nuts. But then he finishes by saying, so this is a really long email, I'm kind of just summarizing. On the bright side, the rest of the vehicle is pretty good. Clutch and transmission are pretty strong. Auto-locking hubs are dumb, but generally reliable. Pretty sure the rear axle is a light-duty Dana 44.
Oh, cool.
A bunch of other people said that. I think a lunchbox locker is available from several companies. Seems like you can get about 2 inches of lift from the front from adjusting the torsion bars. Longer rear springs and shackles add a few inches to the rear. Cheap rear add-on springs can add about 1.5 inches to the rear, but it hurts articulation. So, listen, this is kind of like a car that just doesn't exist anymore. There's not a huge community around them, but I don't think we should forget the Rodeo because it was fundamentally a pretty interesting car.
Yeah, and we're going to have some fun with this one. We did go through and check the oil level, and it's not noisy because it's low on oil. It's got some of those issues I think he was describing. So we are essentially going to run it until it doesn't run anymore, I think is the plan.
The good news is he was kind of saying that you can kind of just let him keep ticking.
Yeah.
Right? If it's got 238,000 miles, if it's made it this far, it sounds like it'll kind of just keep going until it...
until it doesn't.
Pops. But
and
so
that's the plan.
We're going to try that. But let us know what you want to see with this Rodeo, guys. I think tires and I think an off-road adventure would be pretty fun on this thing. Maybe we'll fix like the valve cover gasket leak because it's pretty atrocious. But apart from that, the car actually does run and drive pretty well.
And then the other vehicle that we were spending some time in adverse driving conditions in recently is another questionable one. Tommy and I went and did some snow wheeling, if you want to call it that, in our Model T, 93-year-old Ford Model T.
99-year-old.
Is it 99?
27.
Oh, wow, yeah. It's 27. No way. Yeah, 99-year-old, so basically 100-year-old Model T. And the way that we got it to work in the snow, because a long time ago, you and Roman had tried to drive our other Model T in the snow.
It didn't move.
Yeah, it went maybe 20 yards.
Uh-huh.
We wrapped rope, almost twine-like rope, very old-timey looking rope, around the tire to act almost like old-timey tire chains.
Yeah, and this is a really interesting hack that I read about a long time ago, and I kind of thought it'd be one of those things where, you know, some old-timers tell you, but does it really work? But the old-timers were exactly on the money. So we took 3/8 gardening rope and then case-tight as knots, and we wrapped it around the tire, I don't know, probably 25 times, something like that, 20 times. And essentially, it digs into the snow and the mud and the grime and then gives you additional traction. And the difference was amazing. Like you said in the old Model T, it barely moved at all. This system caused it to climb up pretty much anything we pointed it at. It was so impressive.
Yeah, we did manage to get it stuck in some really slick clay. But to give context to that, we also took a Kawasaki side-by-side and put it in two-wheel drive on that same bit of clay.
Uh-huh.
And it, too,
was stuck
in two-wheel drive. So, the Model T with a rope wrapped around the rear tires is impressive.
Yeah, I mean, especially considering back then they didn't have all terrains, they didn't have snow tires until the mid-30s, and they weren't super prevalent.
And I think we were seeing some comments of people saying there were chains back then.
Sure, but this was an interesting comment. If you click on the 157 there, Cole, this guy said that this trick has a tendency to actually work better in some cases than chains because the fibers in the rope interact better with the snow than some of the chains. I thought it was really interesting. I don't know where that comment went, but it was a really an insightful comment in that, you know, in some cases, depending on the conditions, this might actually be a better solution than wrapping metal around the rubber.
Which I would believe because Tommy and I have tested over the years a lot of different traction aids for driving in the snow because it always ends up being a pretty popular video toward the beginning of the winter. And we'll do a test that compares. There's quite a few different styles. There's ones that are almost similar to this in their approach. One of the traction aids we've tested is like these big zip ties.
Uh-huh.
That didn't work that well.
It didn't work that well.
There are also these blocks that you could strap to the wheels. That was awful.
Also terrible.
Chains do work, but they can be annoying to put on, especially if they're sized almost right, but not quite right, and configuring them in such a way that they're not going to destroy the face of your wheels, especially on a lot of modern cars that have pretty low-profile tires. The best traction aid that we've tried on modern cars has been the snow socks,
yep,
which do a really good job. It's pretty easy to wrap those around tires. They are kind of pricey, but they do a great job and they're easy to put on and easy to store. But the before and after with rope wrapped around the tire of a Model T might be the best result we've seen ever.
Yeah, pretty crazy.
From before and after. I'm not saying that a Model T with rope around its tires is going to be better than a modern car necessarily with a snow sock, but it might be.
It worked really well.
Yeah. It did, yeah.
And I think that what some of the big takeaways we've learned are, look, these cars were designed before roads were even a thing. Right.
Yeah,
and if you go to the TFL truck main page, I want to show kind of our articulation video. And, you know, it's a transverse mounted leaf spring and solid axles front and back with no sway protection whatsoever. I'm not even talking about sway bars. Go to shorts, Cole. I'm talking about it doesn't even have shock absorbers. So what that means is that the front end has complete and utter freedom to go in whatever direction and at whatever angle it wants. And what that means is you get absolutely bonkers articulation out of these Model Ts because they were designed in an era before roads. So they had to work in dirt and in mud and in clay and that kind of thing. And it really does.
It really does. And it's something that's pretty much completely lost in modern cars. Every time we go on the launch for a new vehicle, they tell us about how there's 5% more torsional rigidity here and there's 10% more stiffness there. Which is great in a sports car, but a lot of times we're going on launch events for some new crossover, and they're telling us about how much stiffer it is. And it used to be that you would get some flex in the frame and everything. Now, granted, the Model T maybe flexes a little too much in the frame because even the body, the
huge
front,
amounts.
The grill and the back end of a Model T will basically be facing different directions.
Yeah.
If you fully articulate them, if there is such a thing, that's probably a bit too much flex. But I actually kind of miss the days of cars having a little bit of give in their frames.
In the when we got us stuck in the snow, we were going up this like slight holes course, and the holes were maybe 4 inches deep. And we got it stuck at the top of the hill and went to go get the side-by-side to pull it out. But the hole was just deep enough to cause a little bit of flex in the body. And even like an inch or two of flex meant that I couldn't open the door.
Yeah.
It was like jammed shut. So anyways, a really interesting little experiment we did. And you can check those videos over at TFL Classics. We'll have those up this weekend. Speaking of which, another Classics thing I've been working on, my new Jeep.
Ooh, true. Yeah. So
this is the In the Garage segment of our off-road podcast.
Yeah. And Tommy was having so much fun with his flat fender Jeep that he decided to buy another.
So the story is I bought this little flat fender Jeep. Case and I blew it apart, and I've been slowly working on it a little bit. But what I've been realizing is, like, especially with the frame, even though I painted over it, it looks pretty nice. There is some pretty bad structural rust that could probably do with some fixing. So I was poking around on Facebook, and I found this Jeep. This is another 47 Willys CJ2A with a blown engine and a clean title. So I picked this one up for $2,900, and my plan is to take essentially two Jeeps and build one nice one out of it. So yeah. I'm going to use the engine out of the first one, and I'm also going to use the rebuilt transmission and transfer case out of the first one, stick it in this one, and then use kind of a hodgepodge of parts that I have to create one good Jeep out of it.
And the nice thing is there's a market for all of the other old parts as well. So
sure.
the parts that Tommy's not going to use can be used.
The extra tub I've already purchased.
Yeah, so those extra parts can be used to make other people's Jeeps complete.
Yeah, exactly. That's what's great about these things is they're kind of like Legos, so they never fully die. Like, it's kind of technically impossible to kill one, although I'm working on it. But, yeah, this is a really cool little Jeep. So it was owned by this guy who bought it in the 1980s, and then the engine blew sometime in the early 90s. It spun a bearing. There you can actually see the original engine in the backseat of that thing. But what's nice about this one is there's just like a lot of better things than the first one I was working on. So I was just putting brake lines on it this past weekend. And like the tabs where the brake lines mount were just completely missing on the first one. And this one has all the tabs already, which is great news, right? Luckily, my engine on the old one was rebuilt. Case pointed out. So I noticed when I was rebuilding it, it was bored 40 over. Which I'm like, oh, this thing's a hot rod. Case is like, no, it's probably just worn out.
Yeah. That amount of bore, it's not like it's not like a big block or so. Well, not that a big block is just bore. You know what I mean. It's not like a bigger displacement engine. It's just been rebuilt at least
100 times.
Twice,
yeah. So Cole, if you go back, I pulled these horrible wheels off and the stupid fender flares and the ridiculous top, and I've got like a picture of kind of what it looks like now, except I just did, there's the interior. Interior was full of junk and garbage. It should be the...
Yeah.
There it is. So I put the wheels on it, and it looks pretty cool. I'm really excited about it.
Totally. This is not going to be great for people listening to this podcast. But yeah, what you've essentially got is a mostly white Jeep with some pretty cool patina on it, yeah. Not a lot of rust, and I think it's going to shape up into something really classic. The idea with the other Jeep that we were working on, mostly Tommy working on, was to repaint it.
Mm-hmm. But this one I think I'm going to leave like this because I really like how kind of the primer's coming through. It's got these like very 70s pinstripes on it. It's
you got to do the split windshield though, right?
Maybe we'll do the split windshield. Yeah,
I think you need that.
I did bedline the inside of it this past weekend, which you're right, it was a pretty fun job.
Yes. DIY bedliner kits are actually a lot of fun to use. You used a different brand. I've used unsponsored Raptor liner kits in the past, and it's been pretty nice. That's what I did the bed of my truck with, and I did the entire exterior in bed liner of a van and of a Tacoma with that same kind of kit. Plus, I think that's the same kit that we used on Baby Yoda, the little Tacoma worked on. Yeah, so I've used that kit a bunch of times, and it was nice, but you got a similar thing, different brand?
Yeah, it was like the JB Weld version, but it seems... I think like it's probably the same. You've got the bed liner and then you mix the hardener in, you shake it up like crazy, you put it in the little included.
Comes with a cheapo little spray nozzle.
Yep,
and then up to compressor.
And spray it on. Some lessons I learned. So I did mask up like the edge of the tub, right? Probably should have masked up more because I probably spent more time cleaning overspray off than I did actually spraying the tub. But I was like, just screw it because the thing's already got patina on it anyway. So I got a little bit of overspray on the tub. Same thing with the dash. But apart from that, like just know that it's going to kind of go everywhere.
Yeah.
And it kind of spits out of the gun. Like I eventually got it so it's got a steady stream, but it does have just a lot of muck that goes everywhere.
Also to clarify, Tommy bedlined the inside of the tub for a little extra traction.
Yes.
The exterior of the tub looks is still going to have factory paint and everything. Yeah. So that's mostly just kind of a functional decision.
Yes. And also the underside of the hood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Living large.
Wow. It's going to be like sound insulation.
The only other thing that I'm stressed about with this project is I looked a little bit into the wiring harness I bought. And I don't think I understand how wiring works at all. So it's going to take a little.
That's tough.
It's going to take a little bit more research because basically what I figured out is the harness that I bought, it's more or less like a universal kit. It's got 12 fuses on it. Mm-hmm. So you're probably thinking, well, that can't be that complicated, and it's not. It just looks intimidating when you're holding like the big bundle of wires.
For sure.
But basically, the problem with these Jeeps, which I'm learning, is that nothing is fused in the modern sense. Like there are a few fuses on the Jeep to begin with, but not many. And basically it's just a wire, like there's a wire that goes from the battery directly to each of the switches and the headlights and the ignition and right where it goes is how I'm understanding it. So like the way the headlights work is there's a wire that goes from the battery to the headlight switch to the headlight, which is great until something shorts and then the thing burns down, right? In theory, there should be a fuse. Mine doesn't have it, but probably was one at some point. But basically, how it's going to work now is I've got one wire that goes from the battery to my little fuse box.
Yeah.
And then from the fuse box, those wires go to like the headlight switch. And then there's a wire that goes from the headlight switch to the headlights. The interesting thing about this wiring harness is it only replaces the wire from the fuse box to the headlight switch. So I still have to run my wire from the headlight switch to the actual headlights.
Right.
So
which is not.
Doesn't
not
sound like it's going to be too bad. I just got to get like some length of some wires. But yeah, it'll be okay because there's only three things that is powered by electricity on this Jeep.
Yeah, it should be pretty straightforward. And it's going to be exciting. It's going to be fun to see that on the road and on the trail and doing some neat stuff out in Moab. Are you going to keep the roll bar that's already on?
I might. It is very solidly mounted.
That's good.
So yeah, we'll see. I got to see what the combo of the roll bar and the 2A windshield looks like because the 3A windshield is a little taller. So right now it's right at the same level. So it may look kind of stupid if I put the 2A windshield on it. So I may end up swapping the roll bar. But for now, I just want to like get the engine in it, the transmission and the transfer case, get it moving. We'll go do some cool videos with it. And it'll be fun. I'm excited about it. Mm-hmm. And I heard big news, everybody. Case got his Land Rover back.
Yeah, I have it back. And it is it is running and driving. I can do both of those things with it. What we've figured out, which it's good to have figured things out, is that actually the transmission is fine, which I'm kind of surprised by because I have had problems with the transmission in the past. So that was my initial assumption. Mm-hmm. But it is instead the transfer case going bad. So I am able to jimmy the transfer case into gear and it'll stay in gear for a little bit, but it's also making a lot of noise and it's going bad. So I'm going to order a rebuilt transfer case. I was thinking about it though. The funny thing about my Corvette powered Land Rover is that by the time I get this new transfer case and eventually when I put some lockers in it, every single part of the driveline, every physical part of the driveline that moves the vehicle from the piston to the rubber touching the road will be different from when it was new. Engine, transmission, transfer case, drive shafts, everything internally in the axles, hub assemblies, wheels, tires, brakes, all that. Also other systems like the steering from the steering wheel to the front wheels. The only original part of any of that is from the back of the steering wheel to the firewall. And that's it.
So what Case has learned is to make a reliable Land Rover, you just start over.
Yeah. And genuinely, that was the plan. I mean, the vehicle itself, the canvas, if you want to call it that I bought was very cheap. Intentionally, because I didn't want to buy something nice like a nice 80 series Land Cruiser or something that's already a nice vehicle and then tear out a good engine for a different engine. I wanted to start with something when the idea was to build something more or less from the ground up. Some people might have a problem with me saying that, but to essentially fully go through something and make a different thing out of it, yeah, I wanted to start with one that wasn't already good.
Well, you did.
Does that make sense?
No. What about your ring and pinion? Are those still factory?
Once I do lockers, they won't be. The axle shafts and the entire diff and everything. It'll even be a different spline count.
Oh my gosh.
And everything. Yeah. So once I do the lockers, the axle tubes will be original.
What about lug nuts?
No. No. Nor the threads, because when I do lockers and everything, I'm going to do new wheel bearings, hub Jeez, assemblies, dude. And everything.
So axle tube is it?
Axle tube will be original. Most of the body and interior will be original. Most of the frame will be original, and that's it.
That's crazy.
Yeah,
that's absolutely nuts.
But that was kind of the goal. I wanted to, again, I'll put air quotes around. I wanted to build a vehicle. Essentially.
But the great news is the 3-month battle to fix the transmission has been solved.
Yeah, transmission works.
Right?
Yeah. I
transfer
drove
case.
It.
It wasn't the shop like astonished when you drove it on the trailer?
Yeah, because the thought was, their thought and mine as well was it was the transmission. And they kind of hit a wall where they were like, we don't know anything else we can do to try and get this to run and to move. So they basically said, go ahead and pick it up. And I was talking to our buddy Jordan, who has dealt with some similar issues in the past, and he told me to mess around with the transfer case for a bit and see if I could get it to go into gear. And I eventually was able to get it to actually go into gear well enough to pull up onto a trailer, which freaked out the shop that I was picking it up from. They were like, how did you just get that to move?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's nice to know what the problem is. New transfer case, and it should be sorted.
Nice. Sweet. Well, we're going to have an update on that soon. We've got some plans on how we're going to get that finished, which we'll talk about in the next podcast. But the last thing I want to talk about is...
Something.
Yes. We'll leave the Jeep discussion for next week, but I do want to do my Tommy talk.
Tommy talk. What's Tommy talking about?
I'm talking about... I think perhaps the single ugliest new vehicle I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know if we were actually going to bring this up.
I feel bold enough to bring it up. Now, listen,
We have had a tumultuous relationship with Subaru in the past, it's fair to say. Yeah. But I genuinely do love a lot of their products. For example, we bought a 23 Crosstrek, and I thought that was a fantastic vehicle for what it is. Our videographer now drives it. It's got like 75,000 miles on it. It's been perfect. I really do like Crosstreks. But I did see what could perhaps be the ugliest vehicle I've ever seen in my entire life. Cole, it is not this one. It is the new Subaru Outback Wilderness. So this is a vehicle. This is interesting. You know, sometimes you see vehicles in pictures and you're like, ah, that's not great. Maybe it'll be better in person. Usually it is better in person.
Mm-hmm.
Until I saw this Outback Wilderness in person.
Worse in person.
It is the worst looking thing I think I've ever seen. Just look up a picture. Yeah, Subaru Outback Wilderness from the back going down the road. What has happened to this vehicle? I mean, I think fundamentally the Outback has always been a very handsome, purposeful,
sure,
station wagon, right?
Yeah, it wasn't offensive.
The new one, though, there's the old one.
It's kind of offensive. Let's see. Yes, there you go. Yeah, it's covered in a lot of...
What did they do? I mean, they took a square design. They should have stopped there. And they just barfed plastic in places there shouldn't be plastic. What is that thing on the tailgate, right? You've got this lift gate and then just... three layers of plastic. There's the base Outback layer, these two weird little rubby things, these crazy yellow lines. What happened to the look of the Outback?
I think the most charitable way you could describe it is a little busy.
It looks like Stevie Wonder tried to make a cake. Like, it's like someone helped him make the actual base of the cake, and it looked pretty good.
And then he decorated it. Well, if you look at the front end is not necessarily great either.
Let's see the front. Yeah, it's not awesome, is it?
No.
I mean, I just don't think that. And then for
the square wheel arches.
The square wheel arches is the worst part.
That something about the side of this vehicle and the proportions of it screams Aztec to me.
It really does. Yeah, and I think it's the way that the plastic has been applied with such vigor, you know?
Forcefully applied, the plastic cladding. I mean, look at the cladding on the door. It looks like it's maybe 6 inches thick.
Yeah, I think the standard Outback is visually fine. The Wilderness is one of the most appalling looking new vehicles I think I've ever seen.
And who knows? By the way, this is almost kind of a dig at Tommy.
Yeah.
Tommy's a fan of the Aztec, but this may be...
This may be more upset than an Aztec.
This may be now's Aztec.
Because the Aztec, yeah, that's a great way of putting it.
The Aztec of today.
The Aztec was spectacularly ugly, but if you squint from a mile away, you can kind of see what they were going for.
Facing the same direction that the Aztec is?
Because the story with the Aztec is it was designed to be an off-road Camaro, right?
Yeah.
And then the bean counters put it on the minivan platform, which is why it got narrow and tall.
The difference is that the Aztec has cool stuff like a tent.
And that a cooler.
That is built into the back. Yeah, and a cooler that lives inside the vehicle.
And a conventional four-speed torque converter automatic.
I'm not sure this has those...
I just don't know what they were going for. I mean, if you, like I said, you can kind of see how maybe sort of the Aztec was supposed to be an off-road Camaro. Maybe. This, I don't know what the design briefing was at all. I mean, what is the purpose of that little, what is that blue square thing by the C-pillar? Why did they just stick a square of blue by the C-pillar?
It's the Defender thing.
Also terrible, but at least on the Defender, you can get like a cargo box there and a ladder.
Which my dad hates.
Yeah, I know your dad hates it, and a lot of people do, which I'm not a fan of it either. But this is just a random blue... Someone stuck a sticky note on the design and said, please fix this, and they used the sticky note as the design element.
Well, it's funny, because so many brands, and not even just automotive, in basically every area of design in this day and age, everyone has leaned so hard toward minimalism. I guess Subaru decided to swing way the opposite way.
Yeah. If this was a store, it would be like that weird tchotchke curio store that no one actually likes to go to because you don't know what's going on inside of it. That's exactly what the design of this is. I'm sorry. I'd love to drive this car. I will never now, of course. But I think that the Outback fundamentally is a is a staple of Colorado, and I really appreciate why it exists, and I really value it as a car. But specifically, this new Outback Wilderness is an appalling abomination to look at.
Yeah.
It really is terrible.
It's the 2026 Aztec.
Yeah. I think that's fair to say. I can't think of a vehicle with a closer design briefing to an Aztec. Mm-hmm. You're exactly right. The cladding on the side, the weird proportions is what makes it especially Aztec-y.
I would have thought you'd be happy they brought back the Aztec.
I love grotesque use of plastic. I think that there's a place for that in society. I just don't think it's on the side of a car.
Yeah, probably not.
Well, guys, I think that's what we got for today's podcast. I'm sure you'll leave your comments in the section below. I'd love to read them. Do you think, Case, final thoughts, the 95 Rodeo or the 26 Outback Wilderness, which is a better looking car?
The Rodeo.
Which is already the dumpiest looking thing
we
own.
It is a little dumpy. Yeah.
Guys, we'll see you in the next one. Thanks for listening to this off-road podcast every other week here on Car Chat. And thanks for watching.